session number 26367, Reel 5.
Commander Stephen, Reel 5. Now, on your return to Britain in very late 1945, I think, you had a period of leave, and your next real posting was to British... Well, not real. Your next posting was to British Naval Headquarters in Germany, where you were basically involved in the disbandment of the German Navy and German Maritime. Now, could you explain a bit about the setup at British Naval Headquarters, Germany? What was it? Where was it? What was going on?
Yes, it was at Minden, and I think all the British headquarters were at Minden then, but the naval one was peculiar. It was in a very fine modern building, which had been a factory, and it won the Hermann Goering Prize for design.
What was unusual about it? What was so good about it, then?
Well, it was a very nice place to work. There were large, airy, well-lit, well-ventilated rooms. Those are all things you don't expect to find on board ship. Of course, we were ashore here. We were very well fed and watered by the German staff, who were all very helpful, good servants, all spoke English. They had, in fact, I think, come from the been stewards in pre-war German liners.
Now, what was your job? Were you a secretary? What was your, were you a captain secretary or the equivalent of? What exactly were you doing?
I was, the senior naval officer of Germany was a rear admiral when I joined the staff. But naturally, as all the authorities were anxious to run down these the expense of having these small establishments all over the thing that had sprung up with the course of the war, the government of Germany at this time was in the hands of the Allied War Commission. I can't remember the exact title.
I know what you mean.
Yes. And this was the naval headquarters of the...
What was your job within it? That's what I'm really trying to get
at. In the Secretariat.
Now, what were you and what were the head naval headquarters doing? This business of running down the German Navy, or what exactly were you doing?
We were... The occupation forces in Germany were all concerned with two aspects. Which were the demobilization of the German forces and the demilitarization of all the places they had occupied.
So what exactly were you doing?
Bandment. And what was the other one? Demilitarization, that's right. And demilitarization was to do with material, making sure that the that their weapons were either destroyed or removed, and disbandment meant that the all the German forces would be completely disbanded.
And how exactly did you go about doing that? Or were you in the Secretariat not that involved in that process?
My office was concerned with disbandment, which meant the personnel side of
the German Navy, yeah.
Yes, the bringing an end to all the naval, to all the armed forces of Germany.
And you would be concentrated on the Navy, I
mean. Yes, and my interest in that was the personnel of the Navy.
And what exactly were you doing to achieve that?
Well,
no, you don't remember that, that's fine.
But anyway, I think disbandment is in itself.
I just meant what you were doing,
Yes.
How you achieved that.
Well, the aim was the...
Oh, we've got the aim, it's the methods.
Yes.
But you don't remember them?
No.
That's fair enough. Now, your next posting was to the Royal Naval Air Station at Eglinton in Northern Ireland. What do you remember about this posting? What were you doing there?
I was the captain secretary.
So the usual duties...
The usual duties of a captain secretary to be in charge of all the correspondence conducted by the captain or on his behalf with all the other authorities.
And one good story there is that how you had a flight in a dual control aircraft. Do you mind telling us about that?
Yes.
As you remember it.
Yep. All the officers on the air station used to try and go for a flight at some stage. Indeed, it was expected of us. And... I remember the occasion when I did it in a dual control aircraft of the station flight.
Do you remember which type of aircraft it was?
Do you know? I can't now.
So what happened then? What was that? Because it was quite an amusing story.
Yes. So I put in a little time on the flight simulator where I learned how easy it was to spin in. And then I joined the senior pilot of the station flight after lunch. A normal meal. No, I needn't bother saying. And after a briefing on how to bail out an emergency, I was strapped into the rear cockpit and we took off. After a period of normal level flight, including a few turns, the pilot asked me, straps nice and tight? And proceeded to put the plane through a whole series of aerobatics, culminating in a number of Cuban eights, which is tracing the figure 8 vertically in the sky. Dive, half roll, climb, half roll, dive, and repeat ad infinitum. After this, I was informed that I was in charge of the plane, which came as a bit of a shock as my joystick was still housed in its clips to one side of my legs. I managed to get it out, and with great difficulty, inserted into the socket, which was oscillating gently between my feet. I then proceeded to get the aircraft flying straight and level according to the instruments. What I didn't know was that the aerobatics had toppled the gyro, so that the only way to fly now was by the seat of your pants. So that when I was instructed to turn 45 degrees to starboard, I proceeded to bank and turn with utmost caution. I must confess to being greatly relieved when the pilot had resumed control, landed the plane, and brought us to a halt in the dispersal. And I was soon on terra firma and found I could keep my balance standing upright. It was only at this stage that I discovered that the hidden motive of the jaunt had been to make me sick, and having to find a hefty tip for the rigger for cleaning up my cockpit. It was therefore a moment of quiet satisfaction when I got into the transport to the captain's office with my wallet intact. Is that logical? Do you understand?
Yes,
that?
I understand.
Yes, I'd have to give the chap a hefty tip.
Now,
that's right.
The next thing is you met your wife while you were... Well, Judith, your wife while you were out there.
That's right.
Do you want to tell that story?
Yes. A third officer, Renz, an air radio specialist named Judith Quibell, joined the station. I have a vivid recollection of our first meeting. I had spent a Sunday with the other Lieutenant S on the station, a Dublin Protestant who had kindly invited me to join him on a visit to his Ulster girlfriend, and later wife, at her parents' home. Very shortly afterwards, he went down with mumps.
So you caught mumps as well?
I caught mumps and from him, and I was put in the station bed in the station sick bay. And there, my friends used to come and visit me by talking to me through the open window as I was on the ground floor. And one day, they brought a newly joined Renz officer to meet me in that way, whose name was Judith Quibell, who is now my wife. And I remember vividly my first seeing her through the window where I was in bed, and then when they moved on, thinking, oh, I'd like to see more of that new Renz officer. And apparently she had thought much the same about me. Anyway, we soon were seeing as much of each other as possible and decided we wanted to get married.
Now, your next posting was when you went out to Ceylon, to Colombo, late 1949.
Yes.
And the main point I want to cover in this was there was a real problem about you being engaged to be married. Can you tell us that story?
I was appointed secretary to the captain in charge, Colombo. And Judith and I agreed that we should accept a period of separation until I was able to arrange accommodation for us in Colombo, which we thought would be much better than to marry and then immediately be separated for an unknown period of time. Fortunately, the Admiralty, having appointed one to an overseas station, were prepared to pay for a bride's passage, which was normally by P&O, subsequently. So it was that on 29th of November 49, I joined HMS Ocean for passage to Ceylon. She was an aircraft carrier with no aircraft or fleet air arm personnel embarked, and therefore had plenty of room for passengers. I found I was sharing a cabin with another Lieutenant S, a couple of years my junior, named Julian Richards, who remains a good friend to this day. During our passage, I found that without actually feeling unwell, I had completely lost my appetite for food, drink, and tobacco. I saw the PMO and can't remember what he said, but it was something like, you will probably feel better again later. But I then went up on deck, where I met the first lieutenant, who exclaimed, good heavens, you've got jaundice. The lighting between decks, though it seemed adequate for all purposes, completely obscured the change in my complexion to bright yellow. So I returned to the sick bay, reported the first lieutenant's diagnosis, and was put in bed in the sick bay, where I stayed for the remainder of the voyage. When the Ocean arrived at Trincomalee on Christmas Day 1949, I was hoisted out on the end of the crane on a stretcher, lowered into a barge, and thus conveyed to shore, and then taken by ambulance to the Royal Naval Hospital. Here, I was brought news that everything had been changed. The post of Capic, Ceylon, had been abolished, and I was now, like Julian, to join the Admiral's office, and that the CNC had declared that all his staff were to be considered seagoing in future, and not eligible to be married accompanied. This drastic change had been prompted by accidents to both his personal staff. The flag lieutenant's wife had run off with the chaplain of all people, and the secretary's wife died tragically when there was a fire in the headquarters where she was working as a cipher officer, and she was tragically killed in the fire. Now,
so what was to happen then? Because you were due to get married, weren't you?
I was, indeed. In May 1950, Vice Admiral G.M. Oliver, CB, DSO, soon to become Sir Geoffrey Oliver, KCB, and later Admiral and GBE, hoisted his flag at Trincomalee, and a week later, I was enjoying a pint of fresh lime squash in the wardroom after a game of tennis when the flag lieutenant came on the telephone to say I was wanted at Admiralty House. I explained that I was wet with sweat from tennis and was told not to worry about that but to come at once. I walked across the playing fields in the evening sun, not knowing what to expect. I was conducted to the sitting room, given a chair, and Mrs. Oliver came straight out with, "We hear you are planning to get married. Now, what can we do to help?" I was quite stunned by this instant reversal of my fortunes, and after a few minutes, it had been agreed that my bride would stay at Admiralty House from her arrival until our marriage in the parish church, where the Admiral would give her away, and the service would be followed by a reception at Admiralty House, where the Olivers would provide champagne, at my expense, of course, after which the CNC's bungalow at Dyatlawa. Have you got the spelling of all these places?
Doesn't matter.
The Navy's own resort in the highlands of Ceylon will be at our disposal for the first week of our honeymoon. I returned to the wardroom quite reeling with relief and joy. After that, the days passed with reasonable celerity, until we had the date of Judith's passage in the P&O liner to Colombo. Happily, Captain Figgles Price, that's F-I-G-U-L-S, which is his Christian name, believe it or not, Captain Figgles Price was due to travel in the same ship to take command of Admiral Oliver's flagship. So it was easier to arrange that I took a ride in the staff car sent to collect him and escort him to Trincomalee, with Judith occupying one of the seats. This drive was one we were to make several times and was always full of sights to attract visitors' eyes. Elephants, both wild and domesticated, monkeys galore, exotic birds, buffalo, and an occasional porcupine. On arrival back at Admiralty House, Judith was received by the Olivers as though she was their own long-missed daughter. And indeed, I believe this was actually how they saw her, as their only daughter had died tragically in a riding accident and their prospects of being able to host a wedding, which is something most married couples must look forward to, died too. Our wedding, which was arranged for the 7th of October 1950, was unusual in that no relation of either bride or groom was present. But this by no means made for a low-key event. Every commissioned officer in the ships at Trincomalee and the naval base and their wives received an invitation which, being from the Commander-in-Chief and Mrs. Oliver, could not be refused. I had arranged the marriage service with the Vicar of Trincomalee, a charming, soft-spoken, austere and celibate Englishman who had lived in Ceylon for many years. I've got his name, but you don't want that, do you?
That's right.
He had recently been transferred to a parish in Colombo, but agreed to come back and conduct the marriage service. So began 53, to the date of writing, years of unalloyed happiness. You don't need that if you've got the date of the marriage, do you?
No, that's all right. Now, I think the best, that, in a way, I think what we do now is if we just, because actually you run to the end of things, if you just sum up the rest of your career with a brief comment on what the jobs were.
Yes, right. Well, you've got up to RNS Eglinton, haven't you?
Well,
have you got SMS Ocean?
We've got up to when you were in Ceylon. So you went to the Admiralty next on training reserves. That was in 52.
Yes. I was there September 52 to August 54. And then from September to December 54, I was doing a course at RNC Greenwich. You don't really want to know anything about that, do you?
Not really. It's just a summary now.
And then in January 55, I joined HMS Gambia, which was the flagship of the East Indies Station. Gambia. I did the Naval Staff course from September 58 to February 59, and that was here in RNC Greenwich, or based on that. And then I was appointed secretary to the Commodore Cyprus and was there from May 59 to May 61 with Judith. And with our eldest child who was born there. And that was, I was extraordinarily lucky. That was an absolutely delightful appointment. And I was so lucky because I arrived just as the people had stopped shooting at us. And I left just before they started shooting at each other. You've probably read that somewhere, haven't you?
What was your next post?
After that, I did the staff course here at Greenwich.
No, that was before that, you said. Before.
Sorry. I beg your pardon. It was before.
So after Cyprus?
After Cyprus, I went to the Admiralty as secretary to the Director General of Personal Services, which meant... what did it mean? He was, in effect, the Deputy Second Sea Lord, Second Sea Lord being the Chief of Naval Personnel. And so I found it a very interesting appointment because one was dealing with all the personnel problems, both individuals, concerning individuals, or... in general, like proposed changes to the regulations and that sort of thing.
And how long were you doing that for?
January 62 to November 63. And then in December 63, I went back to sea in HMS Lahn.
What as?
As the supply officer. I must have been a commander then, or was I?
Up to August 65.
Yeah, that's right. And then in December 65, I joined the defence planning staff. And that lasted until January 68.
What were you doing with them, the defence planning staff?
It's very difficult to answer that, except by saying all the planning... all the planning from the Admiralty, but
that's fair enough. So I was
concerned with the personnel aspect of it.
And your next posting
was to Greenwich, on the staff of the Royal Naval Staff College.
What were you doing there?
Teaching officers who were taking the
on
staff
the supply staff. Side.
No.
On both?
Just the general curriculum of the staff course.
Was that your final posting? Or
no. No. That went on until July 17. In August 70, I was joined the Principal Administrative Officer's Secretariat. The Principal Administrative Officer of the Navy being the Second Sea Lord. Sorry. Being the Fourth Sea Lord.
Yeah.
And then in January 71, I moved to the Principal Personnel Officers Secretariat. And that was the Second Sea Lord and his equivalents in the other services.
How long did you stay with them? 71 to?
Until June 72, when I became Naval Attaché Lima and Defence Attaché Panama. And that lasted until December 74.
Was that your last posting then?
Age of 53, and I was born in 1923, so it takes us up to 76.
So you retired in 1976?
In 1976, I'd be 53. That's right. But it didn't make any difference. I went on working for the Navy in a civilian capacity.
Thank you very much.